Do you know what that building is?
Yes, it's the Federal Reserve.
And what happens in there?
They do some things with money.
Do you know what that building is right there?
National Academies of Science.
It's
National
the Federal Academies. Reserve.
Oh.
Do you know what they do at the Fed?
Do they back up the markets if they fail, the banks or something? Do they, like, insure the banks?
I did pay attention in U.S. history.
Do you know what that building is over there?
No, I don't.
I mean, maybe the Treasury Department?
Close. It's the Fed. Do you know what they do in the Fed?
Federal Reserve. Is that what you mean? Yeah, they control the money.
Actually, that's not far off. The U.S. Federal Reserve, America's central bank, might not be the most recognisable building in the world, but it's arguably one of the most important. I'm Simon Jack, and in this special programme, Inside the Fed, I will take you behind the fortress-like facade where decisions are taken which affect us all. In this programme, as the Fed celebrates 100 years of setting interest rates, controlling the money supply, and acting as lender of last resort to the banks of the world's biggest economy, I want to tell the story of this powerful institution from the inside. In the good old days, if you wanted to fix a financial crisis, it was pretty simple.
A significant chunk of the world's supply of gold resides underneath the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. This is not America's gold, mostly. It's gold belonging to other countries. And what the world thought of as a financial crisis would usually be settled by a person in the vault of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York picking up a few gold bars from one country and moving them into the vault of another country, and then the financial crisis was over.
Today, things are a little more complicated than sliding a few gold bars from one country's pile to the next. Richard Siller is curator at the Museum of American Finance near Wall Street. What does he think the original architects of the Federal Reserve System would make of the Fed 100 years on?
They would be surprised that we're no longer on the gold standard. I think they would be amazed at how much power the Fed has, because when the Fed began, it operated in a few rooms in the U.S. Treasury. Now it has its not just one, but two marble palaces in Washington, plus these great big reserve bank buildings all over the country. So they would think that the little institution that was supposed to make America's money a little more stable and avoid financial crises has really gotten to be a humongous institution of worldwide influence.
In the best of times, you don't have to pay much attention to them, but what we've learned over the last several years is the power they have, which is to create really bottomless amounts of money, whether it's dollars, pounds, euros.
Neil Irwin is a columnist for the Washington Post and author of The Alchemists, a profile of the world's three top central bankers at the time of the 2008 crisis.
This is a remarkable power that society has granted these people. They're a small, insular group. They're a bunch of economists who meet in private and make their decisions in confidence. But the decisions they make ultimately shape the ability of any of us to have a decent living, to have reliable savings. And in that sense, we essentially all rely on them in the same way you rely on the electrical grid or modern plumbing system.
But what is the Fed? Think of it as both the backbone and the bloodstream of the U.S. banking system, designed to protect the American economy from financial crisis. How does it work? Well, at its heart sits the Federal Open Market Committee, which is made up of 12 regional bank presidents from around the country, plus seven governors based in Washington, D.C. Richard Fisher is one of those 19. He's president of the Dallas Federal Reserve.
Think of the Washington, D.C. Board of Governors as the school administration building and the 12 Federal Reserve Banks as being the schools in the field. The 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents are not appointed by the President of the United States, are not approved by the United States Senate. I, as president of a Federal Reserve Bank, have no fear of any political figure, and I do not work for the United States government. The Board of Governors is different. The seven governors are, like Ben Bernanke or his successor, Janet Yellen, nominated by the President of the United States and then confirmed by the United States Senate. So it's a remarkably distributed system.
The early 20th century was scarred by a succession of financial panics. That prompted a group of the day's leading politicians and financiers to meet in secret under the cover of a duck hunting trip on the remote Jekyll Island in Georgia in 1910. 3 years later, on December the 23rd, Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act. This was, in fact, the country's third attempt at a national central bank. The first was formed by Alexander Hamilton under George Washington in 1791, in the face of fierce opposition from Thomas Jefferson. It lasted only 20 years when its charter was allowed to expire. The second attempt was killed off by Andrew Jackson in 1836. In both instances, people of the day saw these banks as instruments of financial speculation, manipulation, and corruption. That distrust of centralized power is deeply rooted in the American psyche and influenced the designers of the current system. Michael Bordeaux is a professor of economics and the director of the Center for Monetary and Financial History at Rutgers University.
They didn't use the word central bank because they didn't want to be like the central bank, like the Bank of England or the Banque de France. So they wanted something that was American, so it was federal. In some respects, it's a lot like the Eurozone, where you have the ECB in Frankfurt, and then all of the national central banks in the Eurozone, the Banque de France, the Bank of Belgium, etc., they're member banks. And the European system was copied after the Federal Reserve. It's the same federal structure.
Now, here in the center of Washington, just a short walk away from the White House, we find ourselves on Constitution Avenue, home of the Federal Reserve. It is a big marble palace, which is the guardian of the US dollar, the overseer of the world's largest economy, which makes it one of the most powerful institutions on Earth. It's even got its own dedicated police force. We are here to have a look inside, to see what it does, what it means for the global economy, and where it goes from here.
I was granted rare access to the inner sanctum and entered through the ornate atrium under the watchful eye of Demeter, goddess of the harvest and symbol of growth and prosperity.
There are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, and their names are on the wall either side of me here in the atrium. Boston, New York, Cleveland, St. Louis, Minneapolis, a reminder of the agricultural and industrial makeup of the US as it was 100 years ago, and a reminder to the folks who work here that it's not just for people in Washington and New York they go to work, they're here to work for the whole country. And the heads of those 12 regional Federal Reserves, along with the 7 governors, get together to get down to business just through here. Welcome to the nerve center of the global economy, the boardroom. The most important room in the financial world. In this grand chamber, 19 chairs around a table which is 27 feet long and weighs 2 tons. And the financial heavyweights who sit in these chairs decide everything from how many dollars should be an issue, what interest rates should be, whether there should be more quantitative easing, less quantitative easing, decisions which have implications all around the world. And at the center of it all, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, arguably one of the most important people in the world.
I think of the Federal Reserve chair as the second most powerful person in the United States.
Neil Irwin of the Washington Post again.
The president, obviously, is the most powerful. The other contenders for that role, they all ultimately owe their power to the president. The Federal Reserve chair has independence. He or she can steer this powerful central bank in whatever direction they please. They can deploy, as we learned in this crisis, untold amounts of money to address economic ills.
The most intense phase of the crisis in late 08 and early 09, financial panic, both in the United States and in other industrial countries, threatened the stability of the entire global financial system.
It was the recent events of the financial crisis in 2008 that made the Fed and its chairman, Ben Bernanke, household names.
The Federal Reserve, working, as I'll describe, with others, served in its lender of last resort role, provided short-term liquidity to help stabilize key institutions and markets. I think rather than being some ad hoc and unprecedented set of actions, that the Fed's response was very much in keeping with the historic role of central banks, which is to provide lender of last resort facilities in order to calm a panic.
So what was it like to navigate those terrifying times knowing the price of failure would be financial catastrophe? Richard Fisher of the Dallas Fed lived through it.
What was it like? Well, for 18 months, I don't recall having one night's sleep, not one full night's sleep. We had meeting after meeting. Under Chairman Bernanke, he wanted the entire open market committee involved in every decision. And you were asked for your input, and then sometimes you would lay awake at night saying, did I do the right thing? Did I say the right thing? Did I give good advice? So it was a period of extreme stress for all people involved, and especially for Chairman Bernanke, because this was the most complex, difficult environment in which to operate. Someone had to act. And this is what central bankers do. We are the lenders of last resort.
Soon after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, other parts of the system began to fail. AIG, a giant insurance company, was deemed so systemically important that the Fed took the unprecedented step of lending it $85 billion to keep it alive. Donald Cohn was vice chairman at the time, and he said this was new territory for the Fed, and it didn't sit easily with those in the boardroom.
Chairman Bernanke has said this was the decision in the crisis that made him the angriest. I would say it didn't show on his face or in a raised voice. He was very calm through the whole crisis. I've joked with him that whatever he was smoking, I needed some of.
The financial crisis caused by the failure of a big American bank is continuing. Share prices around the world are sliding.
David Stockton worked at the Fed for nearly 30 years. He was chief economist at the time of the crisis.
It went from being very stressful to being terrifying at times. You know, you'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and check your BlackBerry and see that there would be a meeting scheduled for 5 a.m. And you had to jump in your car, get to work. And every morning it seemed like there was some new market, some new area of the world's global economy and financial system that was in trouble. And people had to think pretty quickly about how to approach those problems.
Did anyone know what they were doing?
I think the Federal Reserve was incredibly fortunate to have somebody of Ben Bernanke's talents sort of providing leadership. He was the kind of person that could walk into the boardroom for a Sunday evening meeting starting at 9 o'clock when a decision had to be made by 10 o'clock in the evening. And he had the effect of making everybody else in the room calmer. And that's actually a pretty significant leadership talent.
Neil Irwin again.
Tim Geithner called Ben Bernanke the Buddha of central bankers. I think that's certainly right. About equally bald and has a smaller belly than Buddha. I'll add one more thing about Ben Bernanke. It's almost a cliche now. Ben Bernanke is a scholar of the Great Depression. As far as I can tell, when he was being considered to be the next Fed chair, that didn't rise to consideration at all. I don't think when George W. Bush was deciding who to name Fed chair, he cared too much about what Ben Bernanke's academic papers had been in the 1980s. But it was a unique fusion of the man and the moment, and that we happened in the U.S. to have this guy in charge of the central bank at a time when, knowing what happened in the Great Depression, what can go wrong when a central banker does not act decisively, was a unique benefit that we had, and it's really a fluke of history.
The Great Depression is a period in the Fed's history that cast a long shadow. Most economists and historians hold the Fed at least partly responsible for exacerbating the misery of the 1930s. It starved the country of credit when it should have been doing the opposite. The lack of leadership at that time left an impression that lasts to this day. Back inside the boardroom where these crucial decisions are made, I spoke to Mark Carlson, who has studied the Fed's response to crises over the last 100 years. I wondered how well it's learnt the lessons of the past.
The Federal Reserve has had to innovate each time during each crisis to respond to the particular circumstances. Being innovative is an important part of being a lender of last resort.
We're sitting here in the grand chamber of the boardroom of the Federal Reserve. I just wonder, in the last 100 years, have the folks who sit in these chairs got any better at dealing with crises, or is it a different crisis every time, so the lessons of the past don't apply?
So I think they've learned each time. The response to the most recent crisis is very telling in that we learned a lot from the past experiences in terms of what we did and the extent to which we did it. And so I think they did much better this time than they had done certainly in the Great Depression.
The Depression was a bleak chapter in the Fed's history. Most economists blame the Fed, at least in part, for deepening the misery of the 1930s. It starved the economy of credit when it should have been doing the opposite. Lessons learnt had to see it through the financing of several wars, a fight for its own political independence during the 1950s, and a battle against the rampant inflation of the late 70s, a battle eventually won by the central banking giant, both literally at 6'7", and in the annals of Fed history, Paul Volcker. His successor was to rule over the nice period, non-inflationary constant expansion, the Alan Greenspan years. Alice Rivlin, former vice chair, described what the board meetings were like during that period.
When I was there, it always started with each person giving their view of what the situation in the economy was. That was interesting because it was a slightly different perspective than we had in Washington. Then Chairman Alan Greenspan would lead a discussion of what we ought to do. He didn't speak in the first round, usually, but in the second round, he would initiate the conversation, and we'd go around again, all 19, talking about what we ought to do. Should we raise the interest rate, keep it the same, lower it? Around the table, it was pretty clear stuff. Alan didn't like to communicate with the public as clearly because he was, I think, always afraid that that would move markets and communicate what the Federal Reserve was going to do.
And guess what? He was right to worry. This little snippet of one of his speeches reverberated through global financial markets.
How do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values?
The city this afternoon stunned by the biggest one-day fall on the London markets for 4 years. The mini crash had been triggered by a speech last night by Alan Greenspan. He'd warned that US stocks were overvalued and the bubble had to burst.
So the Fed had learned that communication was a powerful tool, but one that needed to be handled with care. David Stockton, former Fed chief economist.
Actually, the evolution of communications Fed did begin under Alan Greenspan. There was a greater effort. When I first arrived at the Fed didn't even say anything after an FOMC meeting about whether it had tightened or loosened policy and left financial markets to guess about that based on Federal Reserve actions.
And communication as a policy instrument has become even more useful in dealing with the challenges facing the modern-day Fed.
During the crisis, once interest rates, in fact, got reduced to zero, the Fed needed to think about how it was going to be providing additional stimulus to an economy that was already sitting there with rates that could go no lower. And one of the tools available was to provide what's called forward guidance, which is just giving the markets and the public a sense about where interest rates might be headed over the longer term. Now, that's proven to be a challenge. Certainly, markets tend to react and quite often overreact to statements made by the Federal Reserve or other central bankers about the course of interest rates. And we saw that most recently starting in the spring in the United States when the Chairman Bernanke first mentioned that maybe tapering could start later this year, and the markets reacted very significantly. And then the Fed trying to talk back the markets from that overreaction has proven a challenge as well.
The Fed has learned a phrase or word can move trillions of dollars around the world. Twin that with unlimited financial firepower in the hands of a very few unelected technocrats, and it's perhaps no surprise that some, such as former Congressman Ron Paul, have begun to wonder if the Fed is just too powerful.
The Federal Reserve is the culprit. It has delivered this crisis to us. The Federal Reserve's low interest rate policy is a big mistake. It is not a panacea. Let us restore a policy of prosperity, peace, and liberty. The time has come. Let's end the Fed.
Questioning the Fed's remit is occupying the minds of other lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Kevin Brady is a Republican congressman from Texas.
What I've found is that it is difficult to have a thoughtful discussion on the role of the Fed without either being quickly stereotyped into the group that wants to abolish the Fed or attempting to discuss the issue of the Fed's mandates during a time of very high employment. Both of those are difficult hurdles.
The Fed has a dual mandate: maximize employment while keeping inflation in check. As chairman of Congress's Joint Economic Committee, Kevin Brady worries that the extraordinary amount of money the Fed is pumping into the financial system could be doing lasting economic damage.
I have a couple concerns. One, it's clear that quantitative easing has run its course as far as being effective. Fed is tying continued QE to employment, a measurement they can't control and readily admit to that, and frankly is not a very accurate measurement anyway of our economy. I'm concerned they're adding more uncertainty to the marketplace. Wall Street is doing great. Main Street, not so well. I'm concerned they're sowing the seeds for future inflation. Are supremely confident they can withdraw and taper in time, but frankly, central banks don't have a great record in that regard. So my hope is, in our reforms, to refocus the Fed on what we know works, which is protecting the value of the dollar over time.
The increased scrutiny of the Fed's decision-making process and bringing more congressional oversight into it, more political oversight into it. Some would say, of the two decision-making bodies, I'll take the Fed over what's going on here right now.
Well, and I couldn't blame them for that discussion at this point. It is not a pretty sight. I think part of the reason for that is that Congress and the president equally have shirked the responsibility for addressing these issues. And the Fed, to my chagrin, has never turned to the White House and the president said, we have done all that we can. It is now up to you. You have to step forward to address these issues. I think, frankly, that'd be very helpful.
As it happens, Kevin Brady and Ron Paul are both Texans, as is Richard Fisher of the Dallas Fed.
It's a tradition in Texas to criticize the Fed. Congressman Paul was not in any way unique. We had, in the old days, Henry B. Gonzalez, who was a very prominent Democrat who would have been very happy had the Fed disappeared. I could give you an entire history of the way Texans view any centralized authority, including the Federal Reserve, with suspicion. The way to address that, as I will always do when I'm asked about it, is which would you prefer, to have the Federal Reserve operate the monetary system or 435 members of Congress who can't even get a budget together and can't even behave and can't even do what's right for the country on the fiscal side? You want them to run monetary policy, and then you just get broad laughter in any audience.
In February, the mantle of responsibility will pass to the first woman to hold the position of chairman, Janet Yellen. She will have to guide the Fed through its latest and possibly greatest economic experiment. It's the one the Fed is conducting right now, quantitative easing, the pumping of trillions of dollars of new money into the U.S. economy.
The Federal Reserve is using its monetary policy tools to promote a more robust recovery. A strong recovery will ultimately enable the Fed to reduce its monetary accommodation and its reliance on unconventional policy tools such as asset purchases. I believe that supporting the recovery today is the surest path to returning to a more normal approach to monetary policy.
Whether or not it manages a graceful exit from quantitative easing will define the Fed going forward. I asked Donald Cohn, who was there when QE was approved, whether he thought the Fed had become trapped.
I don't think the Fed is trapped. This is a question of getting solid enough economic growth that this special stimulus can be removed. The hope was it would work faster and sooner than it actually has. Certainly that was my hope when I voted for quantitative easing in November, December 08 and more in 09. The expectation was the economy would recover sooner as the banking system got better, as household balance sheets were repaired. It hasn't happened. It's recovered, but the recovery has been slower. So I think saying as planned, I would say that's probably not the case. So there is some disappointment, and that disappointment is reflected in the continued efforts to stimulate the economy, both through QE and through forward guidance, the other part of this unusual program that a lot of central banks are involved in.
It's a very difficult situation and problem that the Federal Reserve is trying to solve.
Nathan Sheets was the director of the International Finance Division at the Federal Reserve Board. He's now a global economist at Citigroup. He recognizes the challenges QE poses to both the Fed and the rest of the global markets.
On the one hand, the Federal Reserve has to do what's best for the U.S. economy. Statutorily, legally, the Federal Reserve is mandated to do two things, achieve price stability in the United States and do what it can to contribute to full employment in the United States. But at the same time, the Federal Reserve has this very important role as issuer of the dollar and in some sense of central bank to the world. And how does it balance those responsibilities, doing what's best for the U.S. economy on the one hand and doing what's best for the global economy on the other? That's a very difficult problem. Now, in general, if you do what's best for the U.S. economy, that means that indirectly you're going to do what's best for the global economy. But there are some times where Federal Reserve policy may create problems for at least parts of the world. And how do you think about that and respond to it? I think this is an issue that the Federal Reserve right now is struggling with.
So the Federal Reserve is a 100-year-old colossus standing astride the world financial system with seemingly limitless power. But on the inside, you'll find thousands of bookish, dedicated, unostentatious economists going about their business, which just so happens to be running the world's most important financial institution. What makes being inside the Fed a place you'd want to be? Nathan Sheets, an 18-year veteran, explains.
There are many people who spend 20, 30 years as employees at the Federal Reserve. And I think what you get there is a sense that the work that you're doing is very, very important. And I don't think that there are very many other places anywhere where you can work where you have that same sense of mission and centrality, that what's going on matters for the United States and for the global economy.
David Stockton is also a long-term Fed veteran, and I asked him how people reacted when he said he worked at the Fed.
Well, my wife would usually ask me, we went to cocktail parties, to just say I was a firefighter, not tell folks that I was a Fed economist. So I took that as some indication that perhaps this wasn't always so scintillating for everybody.
David Stockton's firefighting alter ego is not really much of a disguise. In a way, that's exactly what the Fed has been doing for the last 100 years. Richard Fisher with a vivid last word.
Let me just give you a little example of the way things were and the way things are now, but the principle's the same. In 1920, 1921, the U.S. experienced a brief depression. It affected everywhere, including what was then an agricultural area whose only distinctive feature was it was the largest hat maker in America, and that was Dallas, Texas, a tiny little city. There was a bank that was being overrun by panicked customers withdrawing all their money. A rumor had spread they were going under. One of my predecessors, just in the nick of time, shows up at that bank in an armored car with guards and hauls, and I want you to keep this in perspective, 1921. He brings in $250,000 into the lobby, puts it on a desk, stands on top of the desk, everyone can see it, and then he shouts across that crowded lobby that here's the money, and there's 30 million more sitting in the Federal Reserve vaults down the street, so quit panicking. That ended that bank run. The dimension has grown enormously from someone saying there's $30 million sitting down the street, don't panic, to now there is a balance sheet at the Federal Reserve of approaching $4 trillion. Obviously, things are bigger now and more complicated now, but we perform the same function, and that's why we're about to celebrate our 100th anniversary.
The BBC